You have your hats on. Om Sahana Bhavatu, Sahana Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejasvinavatitamastu Ma Vishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. What would be a wise way to choose a partner, not to project our inner children, etc.? Have your parents choose for you. That's a joke. But I'll tell you, there's because the arranged marriages are still very dominant in India, even though there's a lot of what they call love marriages also. But I think it's interesting what they keep in mind when they're looking for a partner for their child. And some of it, it makes sense. I mean, I think it would be very, I don't think you can go backwards. I can't imagine that the West would start, you know, looking for love marriages. I mean, arranged marriages. But what they look at might be useful to think about in terms of how you and your partner can make it through life, you know, after all of the kind of, when all the problems start, you know, you're not getting along about this and that, what is really helpful in holding it together. So I'll just list some of them and we can kind of think about it. First of all, the astrology chart is really important. And of course, in India, everybody has their chart done as soon as when the child is born. They have exactly the second and everything, so they have it done right in the Vedic astrology tradition. And in terms of a marriage, there's something like, I'm not quite sure, but something like 12, maybe 12, 9, 10, 12, something, some special number of things that need to agree. And out of those you should have to have at least 7 or 8. I don't remember the numbers exactly. In order for them to think that marriage can be successful. And by agree, it doesn't mean they have to be the same, but they have to be positively aspected, you know. And so then they think just the psyche and just how the two people are astrologically is a good match. And then if it's not, say there's no points or just 2 or 3 points, then they wouldn't want to go for that. And so the parents will actually, before they even meet the young person, they check the charts first. Both parents do, to see if we should even bother looking, because it could be very difficult from the start, and so why do that? Another thing that they're careful about is that the two come from a similar background, like say in reference to the caste system, that they both be brahmanas or even within brahmanas or kshatriyas or whatever they are, the vaishyas, the shudras, that they be the same caste, but also within the caste there are subcastes, so to speak, and that those castes be compatible, because if they're not, then the families the families aren't very compatible. The culture is not very compatible. So they look at that. And then they also look at the socioeconomic factors. Or do they come from similar economic backgrounds? You know, so that they're kind of used to the same things. Socioeconomic is both their society. The society is similar. Their economic background is similar. So they take all of those things, and there's probably more also, but I know for sure those. And then, if those all match up, then I think this is really interesting. Then they will take the boy's parents bring the boy to the girl's house. The parents have this all arranged. And then they serve, I think the girl serves tea and, you know, biscuits or whatever. And the boy sits over here with her parents, and then the girl sits over here with her parents. And then, you know, they just kind of look at each other, say a few words, you know. But honestly, it's all about attraction. It's like, they'll ask the boy privately, the parents will ask the boy privately afterwards, what do you think, you know, do you like her, you know, whatever they say, and, you know, you say the same thing to the girl. You know, what do you think? It's really just almost visual. Is there some sort of visual attraction, you know, or just, it's not just visual, you can feel another person's energy or just how they look at you. Somebody you relate on kind of almost like a soul level, I think, you know, through the eyes and just a certain thing. And so both of them have to say yes. If one says no, then they don't go any further. We don't try to talk them into it. This is all my understanding from hearing from Swamiji, because that's not a good start, you know? Like, just think for yourself, there's so many people in the world and so many men and women that you pass by, and it's not like you're attracted to everyone. Not at all, you know? So there has to be something that you feel comfortable and, oh yeah, I'd like to be with that person like that. And so that's what they take into account, all of those things. And before they even get to meet, the two people get to meet each other, all these other underlying factors like the astrology, you know, and the socioeconomic and what the caste system, how they kind of fit into that, and all of those things are taken into consideration. And then there's another important factor that is a little different. This is kind of the things that they take into consideration. The other thing is that the marriage, getting married, is not about falling in love. It's not because you fall in love with somebody and then you marry them because you're in the bliss bubble and, you know, the attraction is so much and you're so happy being with that parent. That isn't the criterion at all. For them, they feel that love comes over time, and that you're actually a family. You're there as a family, and a family isn't about falling in love and being in love. It's more of a lifetime commitment that we are together, and we're going to have children, and we're going to make a family. And then it's all about Dharma, serving each other and building this type of family, family home. It's not about falling in love and then falling out of love. Fall in love, you get married. Fall out of love, you get divorced. It is something more containing than that. And then within that marriage, sometimes you love each other and sometimes you don't, you know. My mother used to, and my parents, I think they made it to 54 years, I think. And my mother used to told me on a couple of occasions that you know, marriage is made of a bunch of tiny divorces. And another thing she said was what saves it is that both people don't want to divorce at the same time. Yeah. I thought that was very interesting, because they actually made it through, after all. You know, it wasn't easy. And another thing she said to me was that, because you're looking like at 50 years, that's a, you're, whole life. You know, sometimes you're in love, sometimes you're just friends, you know, just good friends. Sometimes it's romantic and you're in love with each other. You know, sometimes you're kind of distant from each other. And it just keeps changing. She said, sometimes you can go for a couple of years, you know, and maybe just be friendly with each other, but there's nothing really happening, but it's a family, you know. So I think that's very sane. Because what if you expect to fall in love with somebody and then you're supposed to stay in love with them for your whole life? That isn't true. That's not going to happen. You can come in and out of these really romantic periods and all of that, but it has to be something a much deeper commitment than that, that's so strong and solid, you know, where you can relax and you have a home, you know, and you're both involved with it and you have children, if you do, both involved in it. I think that's, that gives a lot of stability and security to the family and the people involved. It's just about, well we're not getting along. It's all silly. It's just silly. You know, it doesn't work. You know, and people split up because they had a fight or, I don't know. I think you get the point. So, I think in our kind of system, I think the best way to know whether you should, I mean, for us, that kind of attraction and getting to know each other and really wanting to get married and all that, that's very important for us. But I think a really good test, or whatever you want to call it, is don't get married right away. Wait a year or two. And then you'll see, you know, if you can withstand the shadow sides as well as the positive. Because say, in the 6-month bliss bubble or whatever, you're just experiencing the positive grand illusion, you know, of in-loveness. And then that has to drop off, and then you have to see if I still like the person once that grand illusion has dropped off. That's a big thing, you know. Now you're just two people and this thing has slithered away and then you're just left there with the two of you without the illusion. So that's a marker, and then you still want to be together. That's a beautiful thing. But then if you're able to wait for a year, a year and a half, or 2 years, whatever, then you get to pretty much see all the sides of the person. You know, all of their quirks, all of their shadow things, all of their hurts. And it's important to see that, because you can see if the two of you, like maybe you have this set of hurts, you know, but your set of hurts is compatible with the other person, so that where you're hurt, they're supportive. That's like lock and key. They fit together well, and so you can grow. And then the other person's, you know, their set of hurts and conscious things, and fit in very well with you. So you are, find yourself very supportive and able to handle their shadow, and material and their sensitive areas. But what if, for instance, your very sensitive areas really trigger the other person's really sensitive areas, all in unconscious, you know, then that's very kind of hurtful and explosive, because neither one of you can hold the unconscious little ones of the other, because they just act as triggers rather than invoke your love and your patience. So that's why if you can be with somebody for a while until you really know what you're getting into, and it's a much more conscious decision because you know each other. It's not just marriage out of the bliss bubble. And so that's the only, because I think I can't imagine for us to not have just the initial kind of attraction and whatever it is, compatibility, that just that attraction being what starts it off. As opposed to in India, they don't even get to meet their partner until all of these other things have lined up, you know. Right now, as I understand it now, in this day and age, they ask their parents if they could have a love marriage. Mm. And parents don't like that very much. We'll see. Yeah. I'll still do all of this lining up of all of these things. I think for us, that attraction is really important, and that initial bliss bubble is really important. It's just I wouldn't marry them in it when you're in it, because it's a grand illusion. It has to drop off, and then you have to. even that the two of you can invoke that psychosis. That you're able to invoke that is positive. But I certainly wouldn't marry while I'm in that, you know. Be patient. So I don't know what else to say about that. Any questions about it? I'm not an expert, you know, on this.
I just want to say, like, even 1-2 years can still be very, very sweet, but there's like a 3-year point.
Yeah.
I've noticed a couple of times that's like an edge there.
Yeah. And maybe there's a 5-year and a 7-year. Yeah. Honestly.
Yeah. And maybe we need longer space for all the shadows to play out properly.
Yeah.
How about, I'm not sure how to express this, but like how we unconsciously get attracted to someone and like the things that we're not even aware that we are attracted to, and then like then you start to discover them and yeah, can you talk a bit about that?
Well, that kind of takes us into the Jungian world, which was pretty interesting. For Jung, the unconscious, you have the, let me just give you the kind of the layout for Jung of the psyche. But I have to do it in kind of a circle, and the circle is not really very good image of the psyche, but we're going to do it anyway. So say if you have a circle and you divide it in half, and on the top half you have what's called the conscious mind, and the lord of the conscious mind, or the deity of the conscious mind, is called the ego. And what the ego is, and this is another important thing to realize, is that all of these psychologists and then spiritual groups, they all use this word ego differently. So for Jung, and we don't even use it, and so then what we do is just translate the ahankara as ego, and that really doesn't work, because you have to say which ego are you talking about. So if you decide to use the word ego, you really have to define it for how you mean it. But all they mean, what Jung means by ego, is the one who, it's kind of the sense of self, like here me talking as a conscious being, I have a conscious mind, and I identify with that conscious mind, and I direct the conscious mind, kind of like in the Keno Upanishad. I'm the director of the conscious mind, and I learn, and all of these type of things. That is called the ego, the one who is kind of the self, the center point of the conscious mind. And then in the bottom half of the circle, they have what is called the unconscious. And the unconscious is divided into layers. And the layers themselves are very important. So the first layer is called the shadow. And the shadow, what the shadow is all of the repressed experiences that you've had since in this life. Usually the shadow is filled with like from age 0 to 4. And especially until you're 7 or so, and you start getting some logic and you can make sense out of stuff. And until that time, the defense system just pulls it away and sticks it in the shadow. So the shadow is made up of all your experiences that you were not able to tolerate. And so in order to kind of save you, the defense system puts it into the unconscious, hopefully to be dealt with later. But anyway, so there it is, the loaded shadow. And underneath that, Jung puts what's called the anima and animus. The anima and animus are the contrasexual element of, like, for the man, the contrasexual element would be the anima, and the contrasexual element of the woman would be the animus. And the anima and animus are highly conditioned by shadow experiences. I'll explain that once we get through it a little more deeply. But what that means is, first of all, the part of your unconscious that, in terms of an attraction, to be attracted to someone, for a woman, your animus, with all of the shadow things that have taken place when you were young and therefore conditioning it, it is that animus with the shadow elements around the pure animus hub, if I can call it that, that gets projected onto to the person that you find yourself attracted to. And for the man, it's the same. The contrasexual anima, along with any shadow elements that have been gathered along the way that are relevant to the masculine, or no, for a man, to the feminine, then that gets projected, right, onto whoever it is that you're attracted to. And if there is no, there has to be, from this is Jungian and Jungian language, there has to be something between how this person is that you're attracted to and your particular animus or anima, along with the conditioned shadow aspects that are there. And so now, so far so good? I'll just go on and then just raise your hand if I've lost you. Because the shadow, which is all your unconscious traumas, you know, kind of conditions your anima or animus, that's what projects onto the partner, potential partner. And now that shadow can be mild or not much there at all, or it can be really a problem. And some of the problem, one very common psychological problem we have in terms of the type of person that we're attracted to, it's like what if your father is, you've never felt that he's really wanted you or loved you, he has a bad temper, these kind of things for a woman. She will find herself attracted, can find herself attracted to a similar type of man, because the little girl always is trying to please her father and win him over, especially in these years between these kind of edible years. That I think they're the edible complex, you know, where you fall in love with the little girl, falls in love with her father from like 5, 6, somewhere 4, 5, 6. We see that so much. It's sometimes people don't believe in it, but I've just seen it too much and been kind of, I think it's so, something so sweet. But it is there, you know. Now say she could never win him over, you know, and get that kind of, that love and everything that as a little girl she doesn't even know what she's doing, but she's looking for that. She was not successful. And so she will project him onto, can project him onto some other figure that has the same kind of problem so that she can continue trying to win him over. It's kind of like a developmental need, you know, for her own growth and her own becoming a young teenage girl and then becoming a woman and having this, you know, getting her own husband, you know, like her dad. Her dad and her mom are married and he's the husband. Now she should be able to get her own husband. But even to want her own husband, she has to go through these developmental stages that allows her to separate from her dad, you know, and just be kind of neutral for a while and then do that rebellious stuff that happens in the teenage years, you know, and then she starts being attracted to her own guys, you know. But there's a lot of things that, in developmental things that happen along the way there. And for, you can imagine, like for a boy, a little boy also, who's in love with his mom, but his mom doesn't give him the time of day or the mom is also a little weird in some way. That all gets internalized, and it has to be, the psyche is always trying to go to the next developmental step. And in order to do that, it has to work through these things, these developmental stages. And so what if the developmental stages get kind of thwarted because of the negative, or what do you call negative? What I mean by negative is that the relationship wasn't conducive to the child's being able to grow through that stage and then go into what's more of a kind of just neutral stage, and, you know. So you find yourself, without understanding why, attracted to these men or attracted to these women who are exactly wrong for you. But it's because you're trying to work it out. You're trying to get that, go through that. I mean, there's many psychologies right now. I happen to resonate with this. It's very Jungian, and it's a lot of unconscious things. So I can see these, but there's different psychologies that you can go to. So I'm just using this one. Because these developmental stages are pretty recognized by all the different psychologists, because they're very experiential. You can mark them. Everybody goes through these. So now you find yourself, why am I always attracted to abusive men? Why am I always attracted to men who are really, really angry or impatient, you know, or who are not capable of really loving anybody? You know, why am I attracted to those type of men? Or, you know, a man could say, like, why am I always attracted to these domineering women? It's the last type of woman that I really want, but I always find that these women that I'm attracted to, you know, they end up, you might not say it, but they end up just like my mother, and it's exactly what I want to avoid, you know? But it's the unconscious that is attracted, not your conscious mind. If it was your conscious mind, then you would go around and say, oh, that man looks really nice. I think I'll be attracted to him, you know? you can't do that. What a beautiful woman. Boy, she would make such a good wife. I'd love her to have my children. Now let me just get attracted to her. How can I do that? Imagine. It doesn't happen like that. They say that's an unconscious process. And so a lot of times in the psychology world, when we're dealing with our clients, this is a very common problem that both men and women, I would say, pretty much equally, actually, because after all they're in therapy, so they have a certain openness that some men and women have no openness to that at all. So it's a certain type of person that's open to that type of inquiry. But they see that they're not attracted to people who would give them a good, who would be really wonderful to be with. They're continually attracted to people who are really, really, really a problem, you know? And so Jung has talked about this, and so when somebody comes in with that type of a problem, we always go back, do a number of things to do. One thing is to really go back into the past, into the upbringing, into the father, what the father was like, what the mother was like, who were your caretakers, you know, and see if there was any really difficult spots in the relationship where you just can't get what you need from your parents in order to move forward. They don't allow it because they're not able to give that themselves. You know, for them it's all unconscious too. They're not going to say, I'm not going to give my daughter that, or, you know, I'm not going to be what my son needs in order for this little 5-year-old boy to fall and be attracted to me. No. That's all crazy. There's no, it's not a thinking thing. It's all unconscious issues, you know. And so, as you start doing some therapy and really working on the level of the anima and animus and kind of doing inner child work and also getting into a relationship with that anima or animus, you know, and they come in your dreams. That's another, in terms of the Jungian world, one way we work with it is your contrasexual element will show up in your dreams. For a woman, if a woman has male figures in the dream, we will always look at them as a possible animus figure in the dream. And for a man, if there's a woman in the dream, you always look at that as a potential anima figure. And then over, say, Jungian analysis is usually double digit. You see, you're usually in analysis for 10 or 11 or 12 years. The Jungians all joke about it. Because it's also kind of a spiritual process, too. So you watch how your contrasexual element in the dream is maturing, you know? Like at first they could be a really rough, say for a woman, really kind of a rough, mean, nasty, you know, guy. And then can become more and more of a person that you would love to be with on a conscious level, but have never had any attraction to. But as that animus figure starts to catch up, dropping off the shadow material with the work that you do and the dream analysis that you do, so the animus figure starts to change, and the type of men that you're attracted to also starts to change, and vice versa for a man, the anima figure begins to change and become something that on a conscious mind you would love to be attracted to, such a beautiful, caring woman, you know. But you're not. You're attracted to these other types. And it's not even that you know that they are those other types, because during the bliss bubble, everything is really good. You know, until that bliss bubble falls off, and then the true colors, the true shadow material starts to really come out, then you realize that you've been attracted to somebody that's not the right, not the type of person you would love to be attracted to, but you're not. So over time, the animus figure changes, even in the dreams. It's always a good sign. And somebody becomes somebody much more compatible with you, much more caring, and all of these type of things.
How is it, how does that work when if you're gay?
That's a good question, and there's a lot of gay analysts also, and they've actually written about this, you know, like it could be, there's so many different things that they say about it. It could be that and I don't think there's agreement on it either, because it's analyzed, of course, everybody, especially in San Francisco, where we have such a huge gay population. It's definitely a question, but it could be something that the whole psychology of a gay person is different. Their whole anima-animus relationship is different. So because what they're attracted, they're, if you look at the anima-animus as the attracting element in the psyche, what if we say like that? I'm telling you, there's a lot of different things. I can give you some really good references of gay analysts that I know and like very much, then they've written books also. So anyway, it could be something that if you accept that there is a difference in the makeup of a gay person in psychological makeup, not because of any kind of abuse or anything like that, but just because they're gay. You have to remember that at least 10% of the entire animal kingdom is gay. And it's not because they have psychological problems. It's because there are gay people. That's how they are. Gay animals, gay dogs, gay everything. So then you have to think, okay, there's a different way that they're structured, you know? And it could be that what we call this anima animus that we're making into, or Jung is making into, an animus for the masculine and an animus for the feminine, that they're either reversed, or the animus itself is not two, that it's the your contrasexual element. You know, how does your contrasexual element work? Or say if we say the same, say you're a man, then we call the the male contrasexual element, the anima. Well, what if the contrasexual element for somebody who's gay is not the anima, it's the animus? Something like that. And you have to play around with this, because actually all of this came out of Jung's mind in the like 30s, 40s, and early 50s. And so it wasn't a major something that he really dealt with. And so it's being dealt with now, and it's been dealt with for about 20, 30 years or so, as far as I know. And there's some good books on it, but I don't know that there's any agreement, except in the recognition that contrasexual element is, even in the word contrasexual, is not contrasexual, you know. And so maybe the gay psyche, you know, has animus, you know, anima, like that, something like that. But it's a good question, and I haven't studied it enough. I have a little bit, but not enough to really tell you how people are really thinking about it now. But the fact is that a gay man is attracted to men and a gay woman is attracted to women. And so there's something, and I think that for all, whether you're straight or gay, it's all still unconscious. You know, it's not like your mind decides that you're going to be attracted to whoever you're attracted to. And so it's something in the very structure of the psyche. Does that make sense? So how to change who you're attracted to? That was basically your question, wasn't it? Tell me again.
I just find it interesting, or to bring more knowledge into how you are attracted unconsciously to someone.
Mm-hmm. Well, from a Jungian standpoint, it has to do with the animus or anima, which has been contaminated. That's a negative sounding word, but what they mean is say if you look at the psyche as having what they call archetypal nodes. And nodes, when say we look at the psyche as kind of a plate, and on this plate there are these nodal points that are all the different archetypes, which have to do with the very that everyone shares. They're like instincts for the psyche. So if you think of these archetypes as instincts for the psyche, then you can get it, because we all share the same instincts. So we all share the same archetypes for the psyche, so that we have a shared psyche, really. I mean, my psyche is like your psyche, but then the experiences that we have that come into the unconscious, where are they going to go? Just into a big bag? You know, all together into a big bag? No, they're attracted to the archetypal nodes that on which they fit. And so when we're looking at the anima and animus as kind of an underneath the shadow. So the shadow, think of it like this, that there's this, you ready for this? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's this, what we call this, what they call the collective, Jung calls the collective unconscious. The personal unconscious is the shadow. Okay. The collective unconscious is all, most people, if you've studied Jung, you've probably heard of this word, collective unconscious. Another better word that he started using later in life is called the objective psyche. Because collective unconscious, you think, you visualize, or I used to anyway, some big giant like Ishwara unconscious. Because it's collective, that everybody exists with, and it's not that. What they mean is that just like each one of us has the same, as though the same set of instincts for the body, and the same blueprint. We have the physical blueprint for the physical body, and then the blueprint, the instincts that fill the physical body. Those are the same. They're like a blueprint. There's also a blueprint to the psyche that all of us share. Okay? And so that's what we call the collective unconscious, or the objective psyche. So we all have one. We all have a psyche. We have the shared part of the psyche, which is just part of having been a human being. And then we have the shadow, which is the personal unconscious, with all of this stuff that's come into our unconscious because we weren't able to handle it. That's why, that's why it's called the shadow. We were not able to assimilate, so there it is, being held for us. And now that shadow material sorts itself out according to the different archetypes that are there in the those archetypal nodes that are there in the collective unconscious. So everybody, for instance, has these, they're usually in the form of dyads. Everybody has a, like a father-daughter, father-son, mother-daughter, mother-son. These are all nodal points. And then there's puberty. So what you want to think, especially for the nodal points, that every child goes through, like what are the common stages that a person goes through first of all? Well, there's first of all those first 3 years of life, you can say, you know, and then you can look at what they call rapprochement, which comes about two or three. These are developmental stages. That rapprochement is when a child's about 2.5 or 3. You know, get ready. But what it is the child is now able to walk and balance and look around and see all, you're all walking and doing all kinds of stuff. So the little child will start thinking, you know, just trying, exploring on her own, walking away and wanting to do her own thing, you know. And so that happens at some particular age between 2 and 3, usually, I think. Just walking around trying to do her own thing and really not wanting you to come. She wants to, or he wants to be independent, you know. And that is very important for the child. And sometimes that's a developmental step where, you know, they've been held long enough. Now they want to explore. So it's the cutest thing. They call it rapprochement because the child will start walking away and exploring, and then will always kind of look back. See if her parents are still there. They're still watching. They're still there, you know. And then explore some more, look back. And then run back and forth. But this is developmental. So these developmental, you can look at these developmental points as like nodal points, the things that they have to pass through. Now, say an insecure parent doesn't want, she wants her baby, or the man wants her baby to just stay and let me continue cuddling you for the rest of your life. Don't leave me. You know, and they get, mothers can, for whatever reason, probably because the way that they were, what happened to them when they were children, they can't let go. And so then the child can't do what it needs to do because the parent gets too possessed and too upset. So the parent's not able to enjoy that developmental process, you know? And so then the child gets held back. This kind of stuff. So these are all developmental, we can say, some of the Jungians who really specialize in the developmental stages of life will look at these as archetypal nodal points that have to be successfully negotiated, just like the Oedipal age. It has to be successfully negotiated so that it doesn't become laden with shadow material, right? So like in the Oedipal age, that would be already the anima animus is getting laden with developmental material that hasn't been able to be fully negotiated, you know, so that the child passes through it and now that's gone and now they're supported on the next level like that. So all of these, because there's certain things that we all go through, you know, we can consider those as archetypes because they're like instincts. We all go through them and we all have challenges along the way. And the challenges along the way that are more than the conscious mind can handle become shadow elements around these developmental nodal points. So you can also look at the teenage, there's many things you can look at, but you can look at also kind of mythological things like naming ceremonies, religious ceremonies, birthdays, marriages, all of these, you know, initiation process when a child goes through puberty, which we don't have. Those used to be very dominant, very important, those initiatory experiences, which have not been fully honored in our era. You know, like with the Indian tribes and all ancient tribes at the time of puberty, the boys and the girls were put through different tests and this and that, you know, to cross over into another era, another age. Those are all development. Marriage, the sexual attraction, marriage and all of these type of things, childbirth and what the needs are at that time. When you become pregnant and give a child, have a child, all of these things are archetypes. And even getting a job and being successful and, you know, having the ego development of becoming a man or a woman in life and being able to negotiate life well up until around 40 years old, when then there's a midlife crisis that has to be negotiated. There's also, that's very archetypal, there's a lot of myths in the world that kind of speak to these nodal points, all of them. And then, of course, death or the wisdom years and all of that. There's all kinds of myths that are talking about these different types of things. So they're viewed as archetypal structures in the psyche that we all share that make us human. So if you think that that is the collective unconscious, and then imagine all of our shadow material, you know, pouring into the unconscious, the defense systems going, okay, you can't handle that. Okay. It's all put, and it all sorts itself out around those nodal points. And so when we do the deeper work, the first thing that always we have to deal with is the shadow, because the shadow is a layer on top of the unconscious, and it's all sorted out around the particular node. And so say the contrasexual or the marriage thing where you find a life partner or even a boyfriend, whatever, or girlfriend, that is going to have shadow elements. And those shadow elements one needs to do some work on in one way or another, you know, or else you'll end up perhaps marrying, being attracted to the wrong, not the best type of person for you, you know. And you'll know, because you'll come to therapy and you'll say, I'm always attracted to these people that are not good for me. I've heard that so much, not just from patients, but from so many people I know. How did this happen? So it takes a lot of work and a lot of consciousness. You can see yourself also how one thing for people who have some level of consciousness and are just not just totally overwhelmed by their shadow material. When you have children or you're a school teacher or whatever, that you make sure, it's almost like a big, big commitment to give your child everything you didn't get. And I think that's very beautiful. You know, that's a way that Bhagawan gave us to work through the shadow material by giving your child what you didn't get. But somebody who's very unconscious, they haven't had that opportunity for whatever reason, they actually give their child exactly what they got. You know, that's also, so we see that line of abuse being passed on because for whatever reasons, that opposite, let me always give this to my child, you know, let me never let that happen, you know. I was thinking the other day, or a week ago or so, we had a meditation and I just kind of made this connection that when you go into working, doing your inner child work, you know, and talking to the little ones, but sometimes you do that, and I've asked you anyway to try this, to do, like, imagine when you were that little, like, how you would have liked it to be, you know, in that given event, you know, how you wish that would have been. And you imagine that and you feel that, and it's such a relief, kind of, when you can do that. But when you do that, you also realize very vividly how hurtful that other way was, how hurtful it was in the way, in that particular instance, what happened, how hurtful that was, whatever it was, you'll see really clearly. And then you'll know very clearly what not to do to your child, and to be able to give what you imagined. Then you say, even when you imagined how you would have wanted it to be, you know, and how that feels for that little one when you do that imagination. It just makes it very, very clear on what a child really needs. It's a good way to, it's a good guideline, you know, because of course what the child needs are the obvious things: to be wanted, to be loved, to be enjoyed, you know, to be respected, you know, to know that you want to be with her or him, and that, like my famous brother-in-law who played Candyland 8 times with his child until the child wore out, you know. While we were all having fun and talking, he was lying down with his kid playing one game of Candyland after another. It just, for my sister and I, it just opened our hearts completely. Like, what wouldn't that be wonderful to have your parent actually want to be with you? Oh, my God. To want to be with you and to want to play games with you. Unbelievable. And how happy he was. He was in heaven playing these games. You know, it was such a beautiful thing. So, you learn so much by doing this inner work, especially when you start to really imagine how you would have loved it to be and see the contrast of how your little girl or boy feels in that situation as opposed to the way they feel in the other situation of what actually happened. I think that's a really good way to really deeply understand what your children want and need. And yeah. Where did we start and where did we end up?
Is it the same being, I mean, there's some kind of attraction also to friends.
Yeah.
Is it the same mechanism?
I think the anima animus is more just really, oh, that's another thing I can talk about. It has really more to do with just that contrasexual falling in loveness. So they don't usually use the anima animus for friendship, though maybe that could play a part. But what they say is, so let me circle around to that, because it could play some part. They don't usually talk about it like that, though. If in your dreams you have a, in the dream there's somebody of your same sex, same gender, then that, they will say, is your shadow. It's not your anima animus. The anima animus is that contrasexual element that is definitely contaminated by the shadow. But the shadow is different. And so say if you journal your dreams or anything, it's interesting to watch the development of the same-sex characters that you have in the dream, because those are often represent your own shadow elements that then is really important to kind of go in and have a relationship with that shadow and see if it can be more integrated, you know. So I'm just wondering how was that, I'm not sure how that would make up in terms of the kind of people that you're attracted to. There just has to be some sort of chemistry there. They don't usually talk about anima animus, but there is a chemistry. Mm-hmm. And where you're drawn to one person and not so much to another. But probably has to do with the shadow. I have to look further, because I only know there's major archetypes. But there's hundreds of archetypes, really. So I would have to look it up, and I bet that I could, or you could look it up. You could say, what is the archetype for close friends? And I bet there's something there. And even in the myths, another thing is, for these archetypal relationships, you find them in the myths around the world. The myths around the world follow the same archetypal structure, archetypal stories. You know? Sometimes you can have more kind of archetypal dreams that are, they're like big dreams, they're like mythological dreams. You know, they call them, they're like mythological dreams, but they could seem, unless a person doesn't know these mythic structures, they could seem like just kind of an ordinary dream. But if you know the kind of mythic archetypal structures, you can see the myth in the dream. That's interesting too. So there might be a, friendship archetype. I wouldn't be surprised, actually, but I don't know about it, or I can't think about it right now. I can't remember. There's wise old man, wise old woman. There's that. There's also the trickster, kind of like Narada in all of the stories, you know. Narada was always, you know, causing trouble. Trickster. So that's an archetype also. Also, the sadhu. There's a sadhu archetype also. The people, a sadhu means the people also who choose celibacy, who choose monastic life. It's not very many people have a dominant archetype for that, but it is considered an archetype. Because monasticism has been there forever, really, you know. Sannyasis have been there forever, you know. As though, and if you go back into the myths of the world, so that's an archetype. So that's a really another beautiful thing about reading myths, because these heroes and heroines in the myths, and interestingly, there are heroines also in the myths, in the ancient myths, whereas they're not very much acknowledged now. But they're especially in the East and in the ancient Greek myths, it's not just men, it's also women. And that's really wonderful for women to have archetypal representatives, so to speak. Not just gods, but goddesses. You're not just men who have challenges in the world, but also women. And that's very, very rewarding for women to have that type of universal support, archetypal support, mythological support. We don't have it so much in the West. But if you go back in time, it is there. That's a good thing.
How about for women, their mother, and for men, the father? Does it follow some specific structures, like psychological structures there as well?
I haven't studied so much of that, but the mother-daughter, father-son relationship, father-daughter have definitely been studied, and so definitely they're there as major archetypal relationships. The mother-daughter relationship, the father-son, father-daughter, those are archetypal relationships, developmental relationships. I haven't studied in that arena for a while, but I know that they're there. Google is good. I love Jung because I've always felt he's kind of like my psychology guru, you know, because he fits so beautifully. He's certainly not a Vedantin, and so that's where Vedanta can help Jung, and Jung can help Vedanta because it's so non-pathological. It really gives you a structure in the psyche that you can be involved in, very involved in, you know, and very helpful to releasing things that have been kind of caught, you know, just by the different type of work you can do, dream work, inner child work, active imagination, things that really release a lot of stuck points in the psyche. And without thinking, you know, that you're a basket case, you've got psychological problems. He doesn't even think like that, really. It has to do with knowing how to be with that psyche, and everybody has, because of shadow, because of experiences, things that are blocked in this way or the other, and we have to work through those. So I've always felt like, and he has a lot in common also with Ishwara, even though he only sees it from the standpoint of the individual. You know, he'll see that you're like the proverb to karma. He'll see that just like a seed grows into an oak tree, not a pine tree, you know, that the life that you're supposed to have also develops according to plan. And the way he talks about it is similar to the proverb to karma. And the way he talks about the whole, the blueprint of the self is very much like Ishwara. So even though he doesn't know what that is exactly, he knows he has the same structure, internal structure for it. It's amazing. And so I've always been really attracted to it and felt like it was useful, a good psychology for Vedantin, because Vedanta helps it, and Jung helps Vedanta in terms of the really outlining the psychology in a way that that we don't do fully, as fully as we do in psychology now. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Om Shanti 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 Harihi Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Harihi Om.